for the Flemish. Not only that, but the French warriors represented the very flower of French chivalry, men who regarded themselves as the finest warriors in all of Europe. The town of Courtrai, located about 24 miles south of Bruges, was a strategic point controlling access from France to Flanders. And so, recognizing its importance, the combined Flemish army marched there. Courtrai, however, was held by a small French garrison, which was then besieged by the Flemish army. Soon, the French army, led by Robert of Artois, also arrived at Courtrai, and after facing off for a few days, the two sides prepared for combat. The day of the battle would be July 11th, 1302. The Flemish army was drawn up with their backs to the walls of Courtrai and a nearby river, and there was a large field between them and the French army. The selection of this site to make their stand was a clever one, because, like much of the Flemish countryside, that intervening field was low-lying, wet land, which was traversed by a number of streams and water channels. Such terrain was not well-suited to charging horsemen. On the other hand, they had backed themselves into a position from which there could be no retreat. They simply had to win, or they would all be killed. The Bruges contingent held the right side of the line, with the men from the surrounding regions in the center, and the group from eastern Flanders on the left. William of Hulick, along with one of the sons, the Count, sent their horses away, and chose to stand in the very front rank holding pikes. And this was a strong, symbolic statement that although they were noblemen, in the coming battle, they would fight side by side with the townspeople and commoners, using their weapons and sharing their danger. Speeches were made urging the militiamen to hold their positions and not let the French break through their line. The chosen battle cry was "Flanders the Lion," as that animal was the heraldic emblem of Flanders. Across the field, the French had held a council of war during which, taking note of the marshy field, the commander of the crossbowmen advised pelting the Flemish army with crossbow bolts and then sending in the foot soldiers to finish them off. The knights, though, bristled at this practical suggestion because it would deprive them of the honor of being the ones to defeat the enemy. A scout dispatched by Robert of Artois to examine the Flemish army returned with a dismissive report. He said, "I've seen nothing but rowdy peasants and weavers, and saw no one of any importance save William of Hulick." Hearing this, Robert declared, "What can such common people do against us? Even if there are many of them, 100 knights are worth 1,000 men on foot." Thus, it was decided that, although the crossbowmen might shoot for a short time to soften up the enemy, the knights would then charge forward to crush them and win the battle. The French knights were assembled into three large groups matching the ones in the Flemish army, and the fight began with the French crossbowmen unleashing a rain of bolts. The Flemish crossbowmen, who were stationed in front of the main line, replied with shots of their own, and a duel of missiles ensued. The French were more numerous and were also supported by infantry, so they drove back the Flemish crossbowmen, who then took shelter behind the main line. The French crossbowmen and foot soldiers were eager to press their advantage, and they might have done so to good effect. But Robert, fearing that they might defeat the Flemish on their own, ordered them back to make way for his knights. The battalions of aristocratic knights ponderously began to move forward, but they couldn't build momentum on the swampy ground. Then, when they had to cross those little streams, it brought their advance to a standstill. After awkwardly picking their way across, they continued on towards the Flemish line, which bristled with lowered pikes. This was the moment of terror for the militiamen who were nervously clutching their weapons. They could only stand there and watch the deadly knights thundering confidently towards them in an unbroken mass of gigantic horses and heavily armored men. Along most of the line, the sturdy townspeople held firm, jabbing with their pikes and, when the opportunity presented, bringing their iron-rimmed Hudendocks crashing down on the exposed head of an unhorsed knight. In the front rank, William of Hulick fought heroically, but he was injured, became exhausted, and collapsed onto the ground. His men pulled him out of danger and dragged him to the rear. Fearing that the Flemish ranks would lose heart without his inspiration, William's servant bravely put on his master's armor and, impersonating him, returned to the fray, shouting, "Hulick is still here!" On the right and left sides, the Flemish line managed to blunt the onslaught. But in the center, French knights cut their way into the Flemish formation and threatened to break through. Seeing this, the commander of the Flemish reserves brought up his troops to bolster the line. Knots of pike and Hudendocked brandishing militia clustered around each knight, hacking and poking until he fell from the saddle, and then pounding on the fallen man until finally someone managed to insert a blade or a point into a weak spot in the armor. The French charge faltered, and then, to Robert's horror, began to retreat. Preferring death on the battlefield to the disgrace of losing, Robert ordered the trumpets to sound the charge, and he led his personal contingent of knights right into the thickest part of the battle. Successful at first, he too was ultimately surrounded and mobbed, eventually being knocked to the ground. With the Flemish soldiers closing in on him, he begged that his beloved war horse be spared. But filled with rage, the Flemish troops killed both of them. After 3 hours of intense combat, the battle was finally winding down. It was an utter disaster for the French. Thousands of France's best warriors lay dead on the bloody field. Among them were 75 high lords and around 1,200 knights. In the aftermath of the battle, the golden spurs worn by 500 of these knights were collected together and mounted on the walls of a nearby church. And it's because of this that the battle has sometimes popularly become known as the Battle of the Golden Spurs. The Battle of Courtrai halted French attempts to seize the region, and it made possible the eventual creation of the Netherlands and Belgium as independent states. The brave servant of William of Hulick, who put on his master's armor, was unfortunately among the casualties on the Flemish side. William himself was killed in battle just 2 years later, again fighting the French. Peter de Koninck, the lowly weaver, was knighted and became an alderman of Bruges, but during yet another round of factional infighting, chose the wrong side and was expelled from the city. The French failed to learn the military lesson of Courtrai, and that lesson was that the era of knightly dominance was coming to an end. And French knights suffered further humiliating defeats by foot soldiers at battles such as Agincourt during the soon-to-begin Hundred Years' War with England. Courtrai illustrates the, by now familiar, errors of overconfidence and not taking the terrain into account. But it also demonstrates the dangers of failing to adapt to change. The French held fixedly to a concept of warfare that had become outdated, and they paid the ultimate price for that rigid thinking. Adaptability and being able to recognize paradigm shifts are important virtues, really, in almost any field of endeavor. And the lack of those qualities directly led to those 500 golden spurs being nailed to the wall of a church in Flanders.
Lecture 9, Nagashino, Taking Swords to a Gunfight,
One of the most powerful agents of change is the development of new technologies, especially ones with military applications. At the Battle of Nagashino in Japan in 1575, tens of thousands of sword-wielding samurai faced off against each other. Up to now, in Japanese history, gunpowder had not played a significant role. But at Nagashino, crude guns proved to be the determining factor in the outcome. Throughout history, the failure to adapt to change has often resulted in fatal mistakes. Both of the opposing armies at Nagashino possessed guns. It is not, therefore, a case of one group gaining a new technology which the other lacked. But only one commander figured out how to employ the guns to maximum effect. The battle thus illustrates the important point that it is not enough to simply have a new or cutting-edge technology. One has to understand how to use it effectively as well. The Battle of Nagashino was the culmination of a conflict that stretched over multiple generations and that had produced some of the most memorable battles and really most colorful figures in Japanese history. During the 16th century, Japan was divided up into numerous fiefdoms controlled by mighty warlords. There was a shogun who supposedly ruled over all of Japan, but he had become a figurehead with little actual power, and he himself was usually under the control of one or more of the warlords. The various lords and the clans that they represented were constantly at war with one another, making and breaking alliances as each strove to make itself dominant. In the latter half of the century, a man named Oda Nobunaga had risen from his original status as a really fairly minor lord to control both the shogun and the capital city of Kyoto. His goal was now to unify all of Japan. Oda was infamous for some eccentric behavior as a youth, but he eventually proved himself to be an outstanding general. In one celebrated clash, he defeated an army that outnumbered his own by a factor of 10-1. He was almost constantly at war during his lifetime, and he steadily expanded his territory. One of Oda's greatest rivals was another skilled general, Takeda Shingen, who was the head of the powerful Takeda clan. He was known as the Tiger of Kai Province for his military prowess, but he also took vows as a Buddhist monk. One of Takeda Shingen's most notable talents was as an organizer and administrator. He built useful public works, such as damming the Fuji River, and he was known for his fair, if sometimes harsh, administration of justice. He organized a famous staff of wise and able military advisors who were known as the 24 Generals. The Takeda Army was renowned for its unusually large and formidable contingent of mounted samurai, and they typically won their engagements by fiercely charging the enemy. In battle, Shingen flew a special banner bearing a quote from the strategist Sun Tzu. It read, "Swift like the wind, quiet like the forest, conquer like the fire, steady as the mountain." And those words became the motto of the Takeda clan. Towards the end of his life, Takeda Shingen was seen as the one man who could stand up to Oda Nobunaga, and Shingen began a campaign against Oda's allies. The most important of those allies was the Tokugawa clan, Their territory lay right between those of Oda and Takeda Shingen. And so accordingly, Shingen began attacking Tokugawa castles. While that conflict was still in its opening stages, however, Shingen died prematurely at the age of 53. According to one version, this came about when he was besieging one of the castles, and he heard a flute being played by one of the defenders at night. Probably foolishly, he snuck in close to the castle because he wanted to listen. Unfortunately, a sniper within it spotted him and shot Shingen in the head, fatally injuring him. With Shingen's death, control of the Takeda clan passed on to his son, Takeda Katsuyori. He was under enormous pressure to live up to the reputation of his illustrious father, and he soon decided to do this by resuming the offensive against Oda and his allies, the Tokugawa clan. After all, what better way to prove himself as a worthy heir than by taking on the greatest warlord in Japan and succeeding where his father had failed? The young Katsuyori's parentage was a little bit controversial. Early in his career, Shingen had defeated a neighboring lord and then compelled him to commit suicide. This man had a particularly beautiful 14-year-old daughter, and Shingen became completely infatuated with her, forcing the girl to marry him. To make matters worse, she was also his own niece. Because of the intensity of his obsession with the girl, a widely believed rumor circulated that she was actually a kitsune. This was a fox that had taken human form. And these sort of shape-shifting foxes are a common feature of many Japanese legends. And they're said often to bewitch humans and lure them to their doom. So when this girl gave birth to a boy and then mysteriously died a few years later, the rumors just grew. And this boy was Takeda Katsuyori, the son who now took over control of the clan after his father Shingen's death. On May 30th, 1575, Takeda Katsuyori led out his army and invaded the Tokugawa's territory. He had a secret plan to capture the main city of the Tokugawa. Katsuyori had made contact with a disaffected, high-ranking official inside the Tokugawa administration. And this man had promised to open up the gates of the city and admit the Takeda samurai. As Katsuyori was marching towards the city, however, the whole plot was uncovered by the Tokugawa. The traitorous official was executed by a particularly novel means. He was buried in the ground with only his head and neck exposed. A dull bamboo saw was placed beside him, and those walking by were invited to use it to hack at his neck. The traitor endured 7 days of this cruel torture before finally expiring. With his death, the entire point of the expedition was now gone, since Katsuyori had no hope of capturing the well-defended city without inside help. But intent on winning glory to try to compete with his father, Katsuyori was reluctant to just withdraw back to his own territory. So he marched to the coast, he burned some small and unimportant fortified outposts, and then, looking for something more significant to accomplish, he attacked one of the Tokugawa castles. This too was well defended, and so the frustrated Katsuyori moved on, seeking an easier target. At last, he came to the castle of Nagashino. This was a relatively small fortress, but it was situated in a strong defensive location on top of some high bluffs overlooking a point where two rivers joined. The castle had a garrison of just 500 men. In addition to its being on the frontier between Takeda and Tokugawa territory, Katsuyori may have been tempted to make it his objective because the commander of the castle happened to be a particularly bitter personal enemy of his. Katsuyori's army numbered about 15,000 men. This was almost half the total strength of the Takeda clan. And so it represents a maximum commitment to this campaign, since many soldiers had to be left behind to hold the Takeda borders against their other enemies. Of those 15,000, over 4,000 were samurai mounted on horses. And this is an unusually large percentage of cavalry. But it reflects the traditional Takeda tactic of favoring a massive cavalry charge to break an enemy. Samurai were highly trained warriors. They were proficient with many weapons, including sword and bow. They were equipped with a variety of types of body armor, ranging from solid breastplates to cuirasses that were composed of hundreds of tiny metal plates held together with intricate bindings. This armor was frequently lacquered, and so it could be quite brightly colored. Metal helmets were standard, as were shin and arm guards. The more elaborate suits of armor, which were worn by wealthy or aristocratic samurai, are really stunning works of art, with hundreds or even thousands of carefully constructed parts and often fanciful decorations. Supplementing the elite samurai were lower-ranking soldiers, known as ashigaru. Their most common weapon was a long stabbing spear, and they tended to have simpler helmets and armor, often emblazoned with the crest of the lord whom they served. The ashigaru typically fought in large blocks of men. Recently, some of the ashigaru had begun to be equipped with primitive matchlock guns. Such guns were a relatively new innovation. They were introduced, probably by Portuguese traders in the mid-1500s. But the Japanese quickly learned to manufacture these weapons themselves. The guns consisted of a metal barrel mounted on a wooden stock. A ball and some gunpowder were loaded down the barrel, and when the gunner wished to fire it, he pressed a trigger device that thrust a burning fuse into the firing pan, igniting some gunpowder, which then set off the main charge. Matchlocks were really inaccurate weapons, and were simply pointed in the direction of an enemy rather than aimed at a specific target. While their theoretical range was several hundred yards, tests have shown that they were most effective at distances less than 50 yards. At that range, the balls had enough force to penetrate typical samurai armor. A well-trained gunner could maybe get off 2 to 3 shots per minute. At Nagashino, the Takeda army included about 700 ashigaru with these matchlocks. By mid-June, Katsuyori had deployed his 15,000 men in contingents encircling the castle of Nagashino, and he cut off all access to and from it. And so the formal siege began. The head of the Tokugawa clan, Tokugawa Ieyasu, was determined to come to the aid of his beleaguered castle. And so he gathered together a relief force of about 8,000 men. That was 3/4 of his total army. And so, just like Katsuyori, he was committing the majority of his strength to the coming battle. His ally, Oda Nobunaga, also mustered a relief column. Now, Oda was the most powerful lord in all of Japan, and he commanded nearly 100,000 men. So of those, he contributed 30,000 to help rescue the fortress. Both Tokugawa and Oda's columns were composed of the usual mix of samurai and ashigaru. But one distinctive aspect of Oda's army was that it contained 3,500 ashigaru bearing matchlocks, and that was a larger percentage than was typical at the time. Altogether, the combined relief force numbered 38,000, and that compares to Katsuyori's 15,000. So the wisest move for Katsuyori would probably have been to just abandon the siege and withdraw. Katsuyori, however, was still eager to win glory and to try and establish his name. And he was confident that his famous, potent, mounted samurai would give him the edge in battle and would allow him to emerge victorious even against a more numerous foe. Meanwhile, in the castle, the defenders were down to only a couple days worth of supplies, and the constant Takeda attacks were threatening to overrun them. Things were beginning to look hopeless, so one samurai named Tori Tsuneemon volunteered to sneak through the blockade and take a message to Oda and Tokugawa, imploring them to come quickly to their rescue. In the middle of the night, on June 23rd, Tori slithered down the cliffs into the river. The Takeda had strung nets to prevent just such an attempt, but Tori managed to slice them with a knife and swim through the Takeda lines. He successfully reached the Allied commanders, and he informed them of the desperate situation within the castle. They promised to hurry to its relief, and now the intrepid Tori tried to sneak back into the fortress in order to deliver the good news. This time, however, the Takeda guards caught him, and he was brought before Katsuyori. Katsuyori offered to let him live and even to join his side if Tori would shout across the river that no relief force was coming and that the garrison should surrender. Tori pretended to agree to this, but then when he was taken out onto the beach so that he could yell his message, instead he bellowed out, "Hold on, help is coming." For this, Katsuyori had the heroic Tori crucified on the riverbank in full view of the castle garrison. Katsuyori now knew that a large enemy army would soon arrive, so he held a council of war to decide on a plan of action. His father's veteran advisors, the famed 24 generals, wisely urged withdrawing back to their own territory. But many of the younger lords wanted to stay and fight. This, of course, was what Katsuyori himself desired to hear, and so he sided with them. The older men then counseled that, well, if they were going to stay, they should quickly storm the castle with an all-out assault so that then they could contend with the larger relief force from behind the barrier of the castle walls. Again, though, this was unwelcome advice, because Katsuyori regarded such a defensive battle as being less glorious than a straight-up head-on encounter between armies in the open. So once again, he rejected the general's recommendation, and he announced that they would attack in the morning. Sensing their own doom in this decision, four of the most senior generals shared a ritual drink of farewell. Meanwhile, the combined armies of Oda and Tokugawa had arrived, and they encamped for the night at a position about 2 miles away from the castle. Both commanders were wary of Katsuyori's excellent cavalry, so they selected a site that would not allow the Takeda horsemen to build up the full momentum of a cavalry charge. They deployed their soldiers in an undulating line on one side of a field that was crossed by several shallow streams. And even though these are just small streams, they would be enough to break up a formation of galloping horsemen. Just behind the last of those obstacles, they set up blocks of Ashigaru armed with matchlocks. Oda had himself recently been on the receiving end of massed matchlock fire. This occurred when he was fighting a group of rebels called the Iko Iki. And this experience had taught him that the optimal way to use these new weapons was to group them all together and then fire them at once in coordinated volleys. The problem with such a strategy was that the gunners were very vulnerable during the lengthy reloading period, especially to mounted samurai. His clever solution was to erect a series of open wooden fences or palisades in front of the formations of matchlock men. That would prevent them from being run down by cavalry. And in addition, other ashigaru, wielding the traditional spears, could poke through the large holes in the palisades to keep attackers at a distance. These fences were not continuous, but they were in a staggered arrangement, with gaps between them through which their own forces could counterattack. In acknowledgement of the importance that he attached to the matchlock ashigaru in his battle plan, Oda assigned his best and his most experienced officers to oversee them. And this was a very interesting decision, because the ashigaru were regarded as being of much lower status than the elite samurai. Therefore, to put his best men in command of them was extremely atypical. But it reflects Oda's innovative personality and his ability to think pragmatically, rather than just being blinded by social conventions. It had rained during the night, but again, having learned from the previous experience the necessity of keeping gunpowder dry, Oda had taken steps to ensure that his men entered the battle with dry powder and fuses. Katsuyori's army was arranged in four divisions, left, right, center, and reserve. And each of those divisions was made up of a mixture of troop types. Just after 6 a.m., on the morning of June 28th, Takeda ordered the war drums to signal the advance, and his famed cavalry swept forward. But the various obstacles slowed up their progress as they tried to traverse the field. Kept under strict discipline by their officers, the allied matchlock men held their fire until the horsemen had closed to within 50 yards of the palisades. Then they blazed away, with three ranks of gunners rotating so as to maximize the volume of shots. While Katsuyori certainly expected his men to take some casualties from enemy guns while charging across the field, the massed nature of the fusillade and the swiftness of the second and third volleys, which was due to the rotating lines of gunners, would have been an unpleasant shock to him. So too were the wooden fences that prevented his cavalry from being able to get at their tormentors. Combat spread all along the line of the palisades as Takeda horsemen searched for a weak point and hacked at the defenders. Meanwhile, the allied ashigaru just kept loading and firing their guns as fast as possible, while other ashigaru poked their pikes to the fence at the menacing horsemen. The Takeda samurai sought out the gaps in the fences, and here the fighting became hand-to-hand, with the allied samurai coming forward to meet them, and ferocious and bloody combat raging in these areas. On the right side of the allied line, the palisades didn't quite extend all the way to the end. So here, the Takeda samurai and their opponents smashed together in a more traditional head-on collision of forces, and the fighting there was especially vicious. While the initial matchlock volleys took a heavy toll, once the Takeda men closed with their enemies, the battle settled down into a long, grueling encounter, with men hacking and stabbing and slashing and shooting at close range. There may actually have been several successive charges, and at some point, Katsuyori ordered his reserves and his personal bodyguard to advance all along the line and join in the fray. In the end, the battle lasted for 8 hours, and a measure of its intensity is that one of the most illustrious of Katsuyori's 24 generals, this was a seasoned old warrior named Baba Nobuharu, began the day with 700 men in his division, but only 80 remained alive a few hours later. By early afternoon, as the Takeda casualties mounted, it was clear that they had lost the battle, and they began to fall back. Oda ordered his men to pursue, and the Takeda contingents lost cohesion as individual groups and men concentrate on trying to save themselves. Katsuyori was in danger of being caught, but in a final act of dedication to his lord, the old veteran, Baba Nobuharu, held off the pursuers, sacrificing himself so that Katsuyori could escape. The battle had been a disaster for the Takeda faction. Out of 15,000 men, 10,000 had been killed, an extraordinarily high casualty rate. Especially crippling to any future military operations were the heavy losses among the corps of experienced officers, including the irreparable loss of 8 of the 24 generals. On the other side, the Allies had suffered 6,000 casualties out of their force of 38,000, also a substantial rate, but nothing like the devastation among the Takeda. After the crushing defeat at Nagashino, Takeda Katsuyori retreated back to his own provinces, and by necessity went into a turtle-like defensive mode. He was able to hang on in that way for another 7 years. But with his military reputation in tatters, his allies and retainers began to desert him. In 1582, Oda and Tokugawa again combined to invade, and stronghold after stronghold fell to them. At last, with his army reduced to just 300 men and his enemies closing in, the ill-fated Katsuyori committed suicide. His head was chopped off and sent to Oda, who supposedly wept upon viewing it. Only a few months after finally defeating Katsuyori, however, Oda himself was assassinated by one of his own generals. The real winner of this whole conflict turned out to be Tokugawa Ieyasu, who adeptly moved into the power vacuum and hugely expanded his territory. Having become one of the most powerful men in Japan, he climbed from success to success, eventually achieving the ultimate goal of uniting the country under his sole domination, and declaring himself shogun in 1603. The Battle of Nagashino had a profound effect on future Japanese warfare. From that point on, it became standard for armies to include large contingents of matchlock-bearing ashigaru, perhaps numbering up to one-third of the total. As at Nagashino, they were employed in massed blocks firing volleys. Fortifications also took on greater importance after everyone had witnessed the usefulness of Oda's palisades. Oda's overwhelming victory at Nagashino can be attributed to his ability to embrace a new technology, as well as the flexibility of mind that allowed him to adapt his strategy and to take account both of that technology's strengths and its weaknesses. In contrast, Katsuyori also had matchlock men, but he scattered them throughout his army so that they had little impact and could not realize their full potential. Additionally, Oda was able to learn from previous experiences and to apply those lessons in the next battle. Thus, when the Ikoiki used guns effectively against him, he later imitated their methods against Katsuyori, and he also remembered the importance of keeping his gunpowder dry. Katsuyori has acquired something of the nature of a tragic figure in Japanese legend. Weighed down by the burden of having to live up to his famous father, and possibly carrying a cursed legacy from his mother, he always did seem fated to come to a bad end. Coupled with his failure to think as innovatively as Oda, the result was effectively the destruction of his clan on the battlefield of Nagashino.
Lecture 10, Cartagena, High Walls, Short Ladders.
On April 9th, 1731, off the coast of Florida, the Rebecca, an English merchant ship, captained by a man named Jenkins, was stopped by a Spanish Coast Guard vessel. The Spanish suspected that the Rebecca was smuggling cargo in violation of a treaty that existed between the two countries. For several decades, Spain and England had been engaged in a struggle for economic advantage in the lucrative ports and territories of the New World. And there had been a number of previous incidents. In this case, when the Rebecca was indeed found to contain forbidden items, the rather excessively zealous Spanish Coast Guard official apparently decided that he would teach the English captain a lesson that he would never forget. In the words of a contemporary account, the Spanish officer abused Captain Jenkins in a most barbarous manner, taking his money, plundering his vessel, and cutting off one of his ears. 7 years later, Jenkins was among those called to testify before Parliament about confrontations with the Spanish. And according to popular legend, he indignantly brandished his severed ear, which he'd apparently kept, before the horrified members of Parliament. Outraged by this, as well as some other alleged abuses, England declared war on Spain. Therefore, the resulting conflict is now known by one of the most unusual names in all of military history, the War of Jenkins' Ear. The most spectacular battle of the War of Jenkins' Ear was a massive amphibious assault that England launched against one of Spain's principal ports in the Americas, the city of Cartagena, today located in Colombia. While this expedition began in an atmosphere of great enthusiasm, with the British harboring grandiose dreams of possibly pushing Spain out of the New World entirely, it ended in failure, embarrassment, and recriminations. When assessing why it was such an utter fiasco, there's plenty of blame to go around. But chief among the reasons for its failure has to be the enmity that arose between the top-ranking British naval officer and his counterpart in charge of the army components of the expedition. Rather than cooperating, these two leaders often worked at cross-purposes, or sometimes even actively undermined one another's efforts. And this inter-service rivalry hamstrung and then really ultimately doomed the whole enterprise. Since much of the story of the Siege of Cartagena revolves around the personalities of the leaders involved, let's start with them. The admiral who commanded the British naval units during the campaign was Edward Vernon, and the general in charge of the army regiments at Cartagena was Thomas Wentworth. However, neither man was the person originally chosen for these top positions. When the expedition was put together, the admiral selected to lead it was a man named Lord Cathcart, and the designated general for the army troops was Alexander Spotswood. As the ships and men were being prepared for departure from England, however, Spotswood died, and Wentworth was promoted up to his position. Then, as the vast armada of warships and transports was traversing the Atlantic, Lord Cathcart fell ill, and he also expired shortly after the crossing was completed. Upon Cathcart's death, his subordinate, Vernon, was elevated to the command role on the Navy side. Unfortunately, it was never quite clear which of these two substitutes was intended to be in overall charge of the expedition. And so for the rest of the campaign, decisions were awkwardly made by a committee of officers. Just to make things worse, Vernon's and Wentworth's personalities clashed, and they developed a dislike bordering on contempt for one another. As an example of their inability to cooperate, a contemporary source describes a perhaps unfortunately typical ending of one of these war councils. Wentworth was interrupted by Vice Admiral Vernon in great heat and passion, and using the most impolite language. To this, General Wentworth made a proper reply, to which the Vice Admiral made no answer, but immediately left the cabin. A participant in the expedition characterized the two men in the following way. Vernon was a man of strong prejudices, boundless arrogance, and overboiling passions, while Wentworth was wholly defective in point of experience, confidence, and resolution. So, before even getting anywhere near the enemy, the British force had lost both of its original leaders, was saddled with their highly antagonistic and dysfunctional replacements, and would have to labor under a divided and unclear chain of command. It was all a recipe for disaster. When not having to work with others, Vernon actually seemed to be a fairly competent admiral. He had gone to sea at an early age, and he had served extensively in the West Indies. He thus had considerable experience and knowledge of the area. In fact, a few years earlier, while leading a squadron of 6 ships, Vernon had daringly attacked and captured the Spanish harbor of Portobello in Panama. This victory received enormous acclaim back in England. Medals were minted bearing Vernon's image, poets composed laudatory panegyrics to him, public banquets were held on his birthday, and king and parliament showered him with praise. The famous Portobello Roads in London, Edinburgh, and Dublin were all named after this event. It was a significant achievement, but the forts guarding Portobello were severely undermanned, and the few defenders within them had simply run away, so that Vernon had not really had to face any serious opposition. This easy victory imbued Vernon with a misleadingly low opinion of Spanish military capabilities and convinced him that a crude frontal assault was all that was needed to defeat them. As an aside, one of Vernon's most lasting contributions to British naval history is that the practice of serving sailors a daily ration of rum combined with water and lime or lemon juice, and this is a mixture known as grog, is attributed to him. While alcohol had long been served to sailors, the addition of the citrus was meant to deter scurvy, although the exact mechanism of how this occurred was not understood at the time. This concoction was introduced by Vernon in 1740, and it became standard throughout the Navy thereafter. Now, Vernon habitually wore a coat made of grogram cloth, a trait which led to his being given the nickname of Old Grog. And so it's from this that the name of the famous drink is derived. At Cartagena, Vernon and Wentworth would face opposition considerably more determined than the defenders of Portobello had been. Much of this is due to the leadership of the Spanish admiral in charge of Cartagena's defense, a man named Blas de Lezo. By the time of Cartagena, de Lezo had amassed a long and colorful record. He had fought in numerous battles across the Mediterranean, in the Pacific, in North Africa, and along the coast of South America. In all of these combats, he had demonstrated considerable bravery and initiative, and he had won many impressive victories. All of the success had come at a steep personal price, however. In 1704, during a fight off the coast of Spain, a cannonball had struck him in the left leg, and it had to be amputated. A few years later, in 1707, at a siege in France, de Lezo lost his left eye. Finally, in 1714, during the siege of Barcelona, his left arm was blown off. As a result of the cumulative loss of all of these body parts, he acquired the nickname El Medio Hombre, literally the half man. but none of these disabilities impaired his continued naval career. And in 1737, this battered but indomitable warrior was given command of the Spanish forces defending Cartagena. With public enthusiasm for the expedition running high, the British government went all out in their effort to conquer Cartagena. The Navy assigned over 50 warships to the endeavor, and this included 29 ships of the line manned by about 15,000 sailors. This amounted to about a quarter of the total ships of the line possessed by England. And if you consider that the English had to control a worldwide empire, it thus represented a huge concentration of their available naval strength. In addition, there were over 100 transport vessels carrying the landing force, which was contributed by the army, and that force consisted of about 10,000 soldiers. Among these troops was a contingent of 3,000 Americans. And this was the first time that levies of American colonists had been included in a major British military campaign. The British officers harbored doubts about the quality of these men. Among the colonial officers was Lawrence Washington, the half-brother of the future American president, George Washington. Altogether, it constituted a mighty armada of 30,000 soldiers and 200 ships, and this means it was one of the largest amphibious expeditions prior to the 20th century. Against this vast force, the defenders of Cartagena seemed badly outmatched. De Lesso had fewer than 3,000 soldiers. So desperate was he for men that a group of 600 local Indians wielding their traditional bows and arrows was pressed into service. One thing Cartagena did have was extensive fortifications. The city is located alongside a large lagoon that has only a very narrow opening to the ocean. This lagoon provides an excellent sheltered harbor, and the entrance was commanded by several forts and batteries of guns. The city of Cartagena itself was also protected by substantial walls, and the violent surf made landing directly on the beach below the city impractical. On the high ground around Cartagena were still several more fortresses and castles. While, in theory, any attackers would have to first force their way into the lagoon past the many forts guarding its entrance, and then still have to assault the city's defenses, De Lesso simply lacked sufficient troops to man all of these fortifications. Finally, De Lesso had a small naval squadron. It consisted of just 6 ships of the line and a handful of subsidiary vessels. Once De Lesso learned that a British armada was being dispatched against him, he immediately embarked on a vigorous program of fixing up Cartagena's walls and forts. Many of these had fallen into disrepair. He even constructed a few new ditches and batteries to defend key points. As the British armada made its cumbersome way across the Atlantic, not only did it lose both of its 2 initial commanders, but the men were ravaged by disease. Crowded together on the transports, the soldiers were beset by smallpox, dysentery, scurvy, and typhus. During the Atlantic crossing, nearly 500 men died, and 1,300 more fell seriously ill. Thus, even before facing the Spanish, over 1/4 of the army troops were dead or debilitated. Their woes were just beginning, however, because upon reaching the tropics, the Europeans were exposed to deadly malaria and yellow fever. At last, in early March of 1741, they arrived off Cartagena. With the ships undermanned to begin with, and with disease running rampant through the crews, Vernon felt he did not have enough sailors to properly man his ships. And so he co-opted a large number of the soldiers for use on board his ships. This action left Wentworth severely short of men to conduct the siege on land. And for the rest of the expedition, there would be constant heated exchanges between the two commanders in which Wentworth desperately begged Vernon to release the soldiers for the land operations, while Vernon insisted that Wentworth had enough men for the task and only grudgingly would dole out small numbers for duties ashore. After assessing the situation, the British decided to first capture the forts guarding the entrance to the lagoon. The largest of these was known as Boca Chica, and to supplement its defenses, De Lesso had drawn up his line of battle ships across the mouth of the channel. Several British warships moved in and began bombarding the forts. Hundreds of troops were landed and several minor fortifications seized. This operation was aided by the fact that due to the Spaniards' lack of troops, some of those forts were not even manned. There was an embarrassing episode when Wentworth sent 800 grenadiers ashore and then, fearing a phantom counterattack, had them re-embark on the boats and then just float around uselessly 20 yards offshore for 2 full hours before finally again ordering them to land. Over the next weeks, the British slowly pushed forward, capturing more forts, ferrying most of the troops ashore, and setting up a camp. Throughout the siege, tensions between the commanders of the army and navy continued. Even the most trivial things became sources of recrimination and resentment. For example, much of the food that had been loaded on board in England had proved to be rotten, and so the men were short on provisions. The sailors supplemented their diet by sending out boats to catch large sea turtles. But when General Wentworth requested that a few small boats be assigned so that his starving soldiers could also catch some turtles, Admiral Vernon refused, saying that the Navy required all of its vessels. There were repeated squabbles over manpower, with Wentworth asking for sailors to help construct gun batteries and Vernon claiming that he just couldn't spare the men. Vernon was in the habit of sending somewhat insulting messages to Wentworth, offering him unwanted advice, accusing him of not moving fast enough in conducting the siege, and really just implying that all the soldiers were lazy. For his part, Wentworth failed to properly assert himself and his authority in order to get the aid that he needed from the Navy. The standard method of capturing major fortifications at this time was to set up a battery of cannons, which would pound the walls until a breach was made, and then troops could dash through and overrun the castle. It was a slow process, often taking weeks. Vernon, who was impatient with this rate of progress, ordered his ships to sail up close to Boca Chica and bombard it, but the only result was that 3 ships were badly damaged. Finally, though, the breach was made, and the assault went forward, and the fortress fell. De Lesso burned several of his ships, sinking them right in the passage, in an attempt to block the English from entering. The English, however, managed to move into the lagoon and to establish themselves there. Now, their next challenge was the string of forts surrounding Cartagena itself. When an early attack succeeded in seizing a minor one of these, Vernon was moved to send an exuberant dispatch back to England in which he implied that Cartagena was already as good as taken. And of course, he claimed most of the credit for the success. This set off a round of celebrations that rivaled the earlier ones for his capture of Portobello. Once again, commemorative medallions were minted. Many of these depicted a subservient De Lesso groveling on the ground before a triumphant Vernon. Unfortunately, all of this was premature. De Lesso, in reality, was just husbanding his limited resources to put up a vigorous defense of the city, and it was far from being subjugated. The main fort protecting Cartagena was the castle of San Lazaro, and British efforts now focused on this last vital defense. With supplies of food and water running out, and the number of healthy soldiers dwindling daily, it was decided that they could not wait until the cannons made a breach in the